Hi, I'm Gordon Lanfear, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, a podcast series where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Barry LePatner. Barry has been featured on CNBC, the New York Times, and one of the nation's leading voices in the construction industry. On the podcast, we discuss the state of construction, how to get more out of every construction project, and why America's roads and bridges are falling apart. If you're a real estate investor, today's episode is well worth a listen.
Barry, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
Glad to be with you, Gordon.
So, law to construction isn't always the most predictable career move. How do you get into the construction industry?
Well, I have a very unique story about that, and it takes a unique story for me to end up where I am some 50 years later. So I started out initially in the enforcement department of the New York Stock Exchange, which was at a time when it was undergoing its own technological problems. And because no one in the industry understood where it would be 1 year or 2 years later, stock methods were recorded manually in those days, so it shows you. I moved to a 20-person firm, which, among its other business, represented architects and engineers in the event of professional liability claims. So for the next 7 years, during which I became a partner of the firm, I traveled all around the country dealing with every type of construction failure, and got to work with the best experts in the world. And at a certain point, before everybody said, boy, you're going to be a named partner in another few years, I said, no, I'm leaving to set up my own firm. So, of course, I wasn't smart enough to realize I was starting a firm to represent architects and engineers during a major recession of 1980 and 81, when no architect or engineer had very much business. But I was out there. And I was very fortunate. Within a very few short years, I realized I had started the first law firm in the country that ever held itself out as representing architects and engineers. And we grew amazingly. And by the time the early 90s came around, I said, wrong business model. I have to represent the owners because they're the ones who make all the decisions. Within a very short period of time, because I was by that time fairly well known in that field, I was representing Goldman Sachs on major buildings. I was representing the new company called Starwood Lodging, who was building the W Hotels. And clients who I would negotiate construction contracts for came to me and said, we don't trust those contractors. We want you to manage the project for us. And so very quickly, I hired architects and other professionals, and we had a project management company. And we managed for the next 25, 30 years projects of all kinds and got to be very well regarded in the industry as people who set the standards, created new model agreements, and the like. So it was a niche business. I fell into it precipitously, but I understood it working with professionals, working with people who were very serious about building and had the opportunity to work all over the country in a field that very few lawyers understand.
So when we're talking about fields that lawyers and many even businessmen don't understand, construction is right up there. And what do you think non-construction people get the most wrong about the construction industry?
Well, it's a great question because most everybody who goes into this industry assumes what they may have heard from others, and most people don't understand what underlies the construction industry. And the most important thing, and I, of course, wrote the industry standard book called Broken Buildings, Busted Budgets, which was the first industry study, which showed several things. One, most of the construction industry is composed of mom and pop shops. They are 1 to 4 persons, sometimes 5 to 9 persons. But when you start talking more than 25 or 30 people, you start talking about less than 1% of all the construction firms in the country. So all around, it's largely a small business, which is highly inefficient. National standards show most contractors make 1% to 4% a year. Not a lot of profit and a tremendous amount of risk. So the whole concept of risk here is little understood. The ones who are most at risk is the owners who go out and get financing for a $10 million, $20 million, or $1 billion project. But underneath that is a whole category of small contractors, small subcontractors, small vendors, suppliers, people all around the world who are contingent upon everything coming together and being right on a product that hardly uses technology. So the other thing to know about this business is, unlike every other industry in America, technology does not govern. It's as it was 50 and 100 years ago.
Well, there are elements of the real estate industry that that's true for as well. So I can't hate on them too much. In terms of that, I wanted to talk kind of about where you see some of those biggest inefficiencies, because we certainly have gone into so many of them in the real estate industry. Where do they exist in construction?
Okay. Let me simplify the answer to that question. The first thing you have to understand is that if an architect and engineer design team does not produce what is called a complete and coordinated set of construction documents for contractors to bid on, if there are errors in that, if there are omissions, if they are not coordinated so that the architect's drawings match up with the structural engineers, match up with the mechanical engineers, the plumbing engineers, all the different kinds of people who come together, fire inspectors, if those are not closely coordinated, contractors cannot give you a fixed price. And so the owner from day one is already at a huge disadvantage. There's going to be change orders. There's going to be natural delays. The project's not going to be finished on time. The lenders are going to end up screaming and they're saying, I need more money because you didn't complete. So those inefficiencies, which are manifest throughout the whole process, start if you as an owner do not know how and you do not have the right architects and engineers who can give you a complete set that is coordinated of design documents for bidding purposes.
So can you speak a little bit more about that bidding process and kind of, you know, how that plays out? Because I think that for people that are investors that are listening to this, that are maybe LPs and maybe they haven't done a whole lot of construction on their own, I think it blows some people's minds that sometimes you have low bid contracting and then the price can drastically change as the deal moves on. I know we've definitely had some construction projects that had unforeseeable changes, and those, you know, are understandable sometimes when you discover something that's grossly wrong with a property that you wouldn't have discovered until afterwards and after demo. But sometimes that low bid contracting is just low bid contracting. And so can you go into that a little bit and kind of how that plays out in the industry?
Okay, several things. You and most people who put the hat on saying owner or construction lender know the term guaranteed maximum price, a GMP contract. Everybody hears this. And what I say and what I make no bones about, that is the biggest myth that exists in this country, along with giant shrimp. Because contractors who rarely have ever seen a complete and coordinated set of design documents always say, we're going to give you a guaranteed maximum price, but buried somewhere in their contract, it says, if we uncover errors and omissions or mistakes or things that are not coordinated, we will stop, advise you, the owner of that. require your architects and engineers to amend the drawings, and then we will proceed with the project at an increased price because we weren't told about these things. So first of all, a GMP contract will always have that warning and it is always a red flag for an owner. Secondly, if you want to have a chance at avoiding that problem, an owner needs a sophisticated project manager who knows all the games, who knows how to tell architects and engineers, make that more detailed, do the coordination, take the necessary time. Third, today, most architects and engineers and most owners say, oh, yes, but we have computer-aided design. We use Revit. We use Autodesk. And we can produce a digital product. I tell you as a fact, almost all of those digital projects that are produced by architects and engineers today go to what is called level 300. It is nice and beautiful, has wonderful things on it, but it is not level 400, which is a complete and coordinated set of design documents. And so if you don't get the design team, even if they're using digital design, they're using Revit, they're using BIM, all the things, the magical words they've uncovered in the last few years, they still are not mostly trained on how to get to that other level. Secondly, owners and lenders must understand is that when you start a project before the plans are completed, when a lender says, I need you to get into the ground fast, so start doing that. Inevitably, the plans are rushed and they are never coordinated. And for sure, they're going to be delayed. Project cost is going to go up for certain. There are studies that show on big projects, there's a 98% certainty that the projects are going to go over budget and the project is going to be 6 months to 18 months delayed. So you have to understand the risks. And I end up spending a lot of time with owners, a lot of time sometimes with the lenders, on explaining the risks that are attendant when you make that decision to start in the ground early and not get a complete and coordinated set of design documents.
So when we talk about solutions to this, many of the solutions I hear in the industry is, well, tech is going to solve this. Right? Do you think there are technical solutions that can solve some of the people problems of the industry?
The industry is averse to a fixed price contract. Understand that, first of all, architects and engineers are not told how to do a complete and coordinated set of documents. It's only when owners insist upon it. And we laugh, but I can walk into most architect and engineering firms and I can get everybody smiling over the fact, when was the last time you did a complete and coordinated set of drawings? Maybe some will say the last time was when you represented the owner, Barry, and you were the project manager, because that's how we got a fixed price. But most times, for instance, you see a school district has a $1 billion budget to build 8 schools. It ends up 4 or 5 years later, they built 5. Why is that? And they spent the $1 billion because in no instance was there a fixed price. There was a cost overrun on every budget. And if you want to test me on that, what you do is you go to a Google and they have a Google alert. You type in construction cost overruns. And every day you will get a list from around the country of projects that have run over budget. It's myriad. So we have an industry-wide problem, and this is a major problem because of the following. The construction industry is about $1.5 trillion a year of our GDP. It's 5% of our GDP. And yet it is the most inefficient, the least technology-driven industry in our world. And we allow this for some reason because of the fact, as I highlighted to you, how architects and engineers are trained, how contractors are given to bid low so they can make claims and make more money and more profits on those change orders, and how construction lenders allow this because what do they care? If there's an extra 6 months, it's an extra 6 months of interest that they're getting on a high-priced construction loan.
So what's the best way for somebody who's building to protect themselves against this and prevent themselves from having these cost overruns and problems?
If someone were coming into the industry today and they wanted to solve that problem, okay, rather than, okay, went over by $50 million, I'll raise the cost of my apartments, or I'll charge a higher rent to all the tenants I'm going to have in the building. If they really wanted to build cost effectively, they've got to control the design. They've got to ask the questions, are we completed? Have all the details in here? And architects and engineers can do that if given sufficient time. And it may take 2, 3, 4 more months for them to get all this stuff together and coordinate the drawings. But it's the most valuable 4 months because we know we've gotten contractor teams in, looked at the plans and specs, said, wow, these are complete. I said, yes, because I'm getting a fixed price from you. And the only way you're going to get another dollar is if we decide to add a floor on top of the building, or we tell you to build the bookcases out of teak instead of oak. And that's how the project is run. But very few people in this country who are in either the lending world, the development world, or the building world fully understand the balance of those risks and how to make a project work from a budgetary standpoint and a scheduling standpoint.
So I think there's very few people in this country that also would disagree with some of the potential risks that are going on a broader construction issue, which is infrastructure and some of the dilemma around that. And you literally wrote the book on some of the infrastructure problems. So I'm curious, can we dive into like what worries you most in the world of infrastructure in the United States?
Well, infrastructure, which of course covers our roads, covers our bridges, covers our national electric grid, covers our dams, covers a whole host of the institutionalized backbone of our society, is critical to our nation. However, as I wrote in the book Too Big to Fall, America's Failing Infrastructure and the Way Forward, what I identified from the research that I did was that our nation took that infrastructure for granted. Largely built in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, into the 80s, our roads and bridges were mostly completed under the federal highway grants by the 80s and 90s. However, we did not allocate money for maintenance. And states, which were given the obligation to fund those maintenance, now most of it would be paid by federal funds if it's a national highway or a national bridge, never understood how to put the time into monitoring and getting the money for maintenance. As a result, to this day, after more than a decade after I wrote the book, most states, and we see from the new American Society of Civil Engineers report card on our infrastructure, that our infrastructure gets like a C-minus rating. Why? Because everywhere you go, bridges are cracking. Bridges have frozen bearings. We don't have enough structural support for the traffic that is on a bridge or a road when it was designed 40 years ago for much less traffic. Dams have holes in it and are leaking and threaten downstream communities. And so when we saw only recently during the Biden administration, they allocated like $1 trillion for infrastructure. A few years later, let me report, most roads and bridges have not been addressed because it takes years for these projects to get outside of the realm of approvals, environmental problems, regulations, putting them out to bid and getting the money flowing. Pennies have been allocated from that $1 trillion bill that came out of the Biden administration for infrastructure. Relatively pennies compared to the amount of money that's sitting there waiting to be allocated to address these problems. And we still have over 8,000 bridges that could fall at a moment's notice.
So I've talked to some lobbyists over the years, because as a developer and someone who works with brokers and developers, we often are worried about, you know, putting in highway exits, or there's all sorts of development that ends up going in. And on both the state and federal level, we've talked to these lobbyists, and they've always mentioned to me that there are kind of two problems. One is the problem that, you know, and we see this in property management, repairs aren't sexy. There's not a whole lot of political capital you get for making repairs. You don't get your name on a repair. And so congressmen and state senators and on both the federal level and the state level don't have a whole lot of love for repairs. And the second issue that we've always heard is the regulatory side, that it's a lot to get a repair done, and there's not as much political capital behind it, so it makes it even more difficult. Do you think that deregulation of the repair process would speed things up and make them effective, or are we just stuck between a rock and a hard place?
I think there are several issues that overlap in response to your question, Gordon. Right now, the money has been allocated. Okay, there has been not all the money necessary. They fall far short of the money necessary to secure our electric grid, our dams, our roads, our bridges, not to mention Amtrak problems. The issue is, number one, we have a shortfall of about 439,000 skilled workers in this country. That's number one.
Yes.
And it's going to grow if the 40% who are migrant workers and who work as people who are critical to projects are not around in the next couple of years. So we have a major problem with that. We have a major problem in the recognition of the critical need for this work. Best example, the bridge in Baltimore that was hit by a tanker. Okay, that bridge has always been designated as a bridge that could fall at a moment's notice. It was both structurally deficient when it was shortly after it was built, and it was what's called fracture critical, meaning if one piece of that bridge was damaged, the whole bridge goes straight down. Those piers were exposed to that kind of traffic from day one. There are dozens and dozens of similar bridges around our nation, just like that Baltimore Harbor Bridge, that can go down on a moment's notice right now. This has been the situation for dozens of years. Yet, nobody wants to blow the whistle and say we need to put in the tens of millions of dollars, or in the case of a new bridge like this, $2 billion, to replace a bridge that when it's down, we bring the harbor of Baltimore to a halt. We're losing tens and tens of millions of dollars every month on shipping costs that now have to go all around to other ports instead of coming into the port of Baltimore. So we need to understand that this is not an idle threat to our economy. It's critical to most states' economy and the supply chain that brings things into our port, not to mention allows shippers in America to ship their goods overseas, and is critical to our nation's security because, of course, in times of critical emergency, our military uses those roads and bridges to allocate forces wherever they're needed.
So, I mean, it's a tremendous amount of risk that we're talking about in the system. And I even remember personally when I lived in New Orleans, there were a couple bridges that were like D and, you know, maybe even F rated that were crossing the Mississippi. And I was always kind of thinking in the back of my mind, a little hesitant, like, do I really want to take this risk to go over and get a pho on the other side of the river? But there's a lot of risk besides personal risk that's involved in this process. And there's, you know, larger institutional risk. And a lot of investors are looking at our infrastructure shortfall as an institutional risk. So how do you think that plays out in terms of developers and big money looking at underwriting that risk as part of their portfolio.
Well, the best example of that is what has happened since COVID. COVID exposed the soft underbelly of the supply chain. Once we understood that ports were closed because of COVID risk, factories across the world were being closed because of that, supply chains were broken, deliveries in America were shut down, dozens of companies overseas realized the need to what they called friendshore or reshore their businesses. And so we were in the process only in these last two or three or four years of seeing tens of billions of dollars of new factories come back. Now, here's the critical part, to friendly shores, which included not just the U.S., but Mexico and Canada. And that's where the cheaper labor was, because it was understood that there's no longer cheaper labor available in the United States. We are not coming back to see the garment industry restored with people in sweatshops sewing and putting caps on buttons on and so on. That will never happen in this country ever again. But what we were bringing back were companies that wanted to create new factories, many of them robot-driven, high-tech factories that were properly situated in places that would allow distributions quickly, more efficiently, and allow costs to come down for many of these companies. What we now have is, and I just finished a long article that's going to be published, we now have a tsunami of problems affecting, yes, the construction industry, but more importantly, the real estate industry and our national economy. And what I cited in that article was, A, what I just mentioned, the shortage of labor, where we need, by the end of this decade, 1,000 additional skilled workers. We already have a shortage of 439,000 skilled workers, according to all of the agencies involved. We now have problems continuing because of supply chain disruptions from COVID that are still reverberating. And these are going to be exacerbated by the new tariffs, of which, as of this month, 40% of container ship capacity between Asia and the United States has been canceled. Then we have persistent high rates, where interest is still at 5.25% from federal funds. It's a 23-year high for most of the part. And manufacturing startups are pulling the plug on new projects because that's a high rate and it prohibits reasonable construction costs. We have soaring material costs. Before the new tariffs, we were seeing 9% annualized jumps, but we had a 34% jump since December 2020. That's huge, driving up the cost for housing that we need so desperately in this country. And just the cost of rising home construction for new family single homes, the average cost has ballooned to $422,000. So we needed to understand this layering on the new tariffs. We're seeing now that we're contributing to an even larger economic uncertainty to the construction industry, but it's going to have shorter and long-term escalations and supply instability, which is going to persist for as long as a decade.
So in terms of that, we've definitely had people dive into the manufacturing side of the tariffs, and we have one of those podcasts coming out just before this, so I'm not going to get into that portion of it. But regarding the construction side of the tariffs and how they're playing out, I'm curious, one of the questions that I hear the most often is, well, some of these tariffs might get solved with regard to some of our non-China trading partners in the interim. And you might see some reductions in tariffs with places like Japan and Korea, and you're starting to see at least little tidbits of information come out of the White House regarding that. But China's still a large force in the supply chain that's involved in the construction industry. If we don't see tariffs reduced on China, and even like let's take all the other tariffs out of play, how do you see that playing out in the construction industry over the next 6 to 12 months?
Not well. 30% of most of the products specified for a construction project come from China, or companies where China sends us to Vietnam to minimize the tariff, and we get it to here or over to India. Remember, many, many products. Let's think about our air conditioners. Let's think about our generators. Let's think about our elevator. Many of them have parts that are critical to those pieces of equipment that come from dozens of different countries and are put together through different supply chains. Maybe they come together and put together in America. Maybe they're put together in Mexico and they come up by truck. But they do come from overseas. And right now, whether we reach an agreement with China or not, I'm told from various contractors and those who are dealing with the supply chains that the uncertainty of those prices in the near-term future now prevents them from giving a fixed price on a project. So an owner may find on a $50 million or $100 million project that 2, 5, 10, or 20% of the products that are going into that project are going to get what's called allowances. We can give you a ballpark number, but until our suppliers tell us in the next 3 or 4 months what the actual price is when they put it on the ship here, or what that finished product is when they finish tallying up all the different pieces that come from 29 different countries, then we'll give you a price. That is what creates fear in the industry. It creates uncertainty about costs, and it creates doubt in the minds of people like business developers or real estate developers who don't have the assurance they can make a profit, or their lenders. And those three things are predominant today when you talk to people in this industry: fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
So one of the things that we're always uncertain about is the future. And I think this is a great opportunity to get into our Real Finds Final Four. And one of the questions that I love to ask is, where do you see the construction industry going 10 years out? Are we going to see potentially more technological change, consolidation? What should we be on the watch for?
Well, depending, first of all, how long the tariffs are kept in place. And looking at the five other problems that I told you are infecting the industry right now, no one can predict where the industry will be 10 years from now. But I can say for certainty that if the tariffs continue for 6 months or more, if interest from the Federal Reserve because of these concerns remains high, if we go towards a recession, if the costs for housing become prohibitive, if research and development projects do not go forward on all the new things that we're going to expect for the next 25 years, which starts with the research and development and the funding from the federal government, then I can tell you we're going to have a very, very insecure real estate design and construction industry for the next decade.
Well, I think in terms of that, one of the other things that we'd love to talk about is, and this is a thing that we've had a long track record of reaching out, and I think you give unique advice on this because you have a website dedicated to this, is what little tidbits of advice would you give a young Barry who maybe is starting out in the industry and maybe doesn't know as much about, you know, construction or law, and just is trying to get their start?
Two things I would go back in time, and aside from telling my young self who wins the Kentucky Derby, which would have speeded up acquisition of riches. But two things. One, life is a long journey. And the number one character that you must bring to it is patience. I think the hardest thing for a young person, especially someone who wants to do good, is ambitious about helping people and wants to build a constituency, wants to build a client list, or wants to get known in an industry, it does require time and patience. And the other thing, I was a big follower of history of the New Deal when I was younger. And I read a book by a New York Times journalist who was the Thomas Friedman of his time, Arthur Kroc. And he was the most respected journalist for the New York Times. And he, in his stories, said, I had to give advice to FDR, who was very frustrated in his first year or two, that the Congress, which didn't like any of the New Deal things, was rejecting all the legislation. And FDR was very frustrated for a little while before it started to pick up steam. And Kroc said to him, things are never as good as you think they are. And they are never as bad as you think they are. And they are never as good as you would like to believe. So we need a sense of balance. We need, take a deep breath. Stuff is going to happen in life. Hold the fort. Keep your eye on the ball. Have some patience. Keep doing good things for people. All the rewards come from those things.
One of the ways we get rewards is, as you mentioned, books. And so I'm curious, besides your own books, which we'll put in the comments below, is there a book that someone should pick up that would give them a little bit more advice, even if it's not construction industry related? We'd love to put that in the comments as well.
Well, Gordon, I would say there were probably three books, none of them related to construction or real estate, that had a huge influence on my life, and probably I've gone back and reread them numerous times. The first one I read as a young man when I realized I was going to be out in the world, and I really had no understanding how people lived and worked outside of my small borough of Brooklyn, New York. And it was Andrew Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Oh, that's a great book. So my grandmother gave it to me on my, I believe, my high school graduation. And she said, look, you got to read this book before you start the process. And admittedly, I think for about 2 years, I was like, this is stupid, whatever. And then I picked it up, just maybe I was on vacation or it was a holiday break, and I started reading it. I was like, oh, this is really good advice. Like, thanks, Grandma. So I can't more recommend that book. And that's a book that we consistently have recommended on this podcast.
Well, you think about it, Gordon. Someday, somebody who doesn't like you or doesn't want to give you a thing that you want, you're going to need to go to them for something. Okay? Well, nobody knows how to tell you how to have that meeting. Andrew Carnegie did. He said, get that person, no matter what, to say yes to you twice. So if you can figure a way on, you find out that that person loves the same sports team that you do, or that they have a hobby just like you, and you start talking about it and you get them to say yes twice, you have started to melt their hearts about their adamancy that you are a horrible person. Andrew Carnegie. And there's a million other pieces of advice in that book. Two other books had a huge influence on me. One is a very little known book that I've given out to 100 people over my lifetime. It's called Timing is Everything. And it's written by a guy named Dennis with one N, Dennis Waitley, W-A-I-T-L-E-Y. And I can't recommend that book enough, because he says everything about our lives, all relationships, all projects, everything we start and do and deal with people is like the seasons. There's four seasons. There's winter time when you have to start do the planning. There's nothing growing, so you're ordering your seeds. You're figuring out things, how you're going to make your field. there's a springtime when you start to plant them and you have to do everything right, water them right, just get them going. There's a summertime when you yield the crops and you say, wow, look at all the beautiful flowers and fruit and vegetables. And then there's the autumn when you have to take everything down and start planning how you're going to do it for the next year. Well, our relationships have those four seasons. And when you think about them, you go, yeah, that's how I remember my old partner. We started off great. We had great plans and eventually fell a cropper for whatever reasons. But if you identify coming into a new season early enough, you avoid mistakes. So I learned a huge amount from the book Timing is Everything. Finally, the book that is my number one novel because it teaches more about the world than any other, War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy.
Oh, Tolstoy is phenomenal.
You learn about the whole world from that book.
So besides Russian literature, one of the ways that we like to get a little bit of additional knowledge on this podcast, and really the whole reason for the podcast, is we believe that the men and women who are in the arena, in their professions or, you know, experts, tend to know the next expert to talk to. And I'm curious, and we won't let you get away with leaving the podcast without dropping at least one name. Who's the next person that should be on?
Well, it happens to be the next person that I want to meet, and I'm making arrangements in order to have that happen. And it is Ezra Klein, who writes for the New York Times, who just came out, co-authored a book called Abundance, which discusses the problem of concentrated power and how concentrated power is making it impossible for us to do things we need for our democracy. Because what he says is that we have overregulated our world built environment. We have seen all good intentions stymie development. We have seen things that we want done that take 5, 7, 8, 10 years because we put in concerns about bad economic development with regulations that prevent the development and promote, and we don't even know how to promote good development going forward. So his book talks about how instead of pursuing growth by backing zoning regulations or strict environmental laws or tying expensive requirements to public infrastructure, we have to simplify the way we identify how to build in this country and how to do it cost effectively and how to do it more quickly to meet our growing needs.
Well, I saw him doing the rounds on a number of podcasts, and I believe he had one conversation, I think it was with Jon Stewart, about this topic, and absolutely fascinating. So there's one last question, though, that we always have to ask, and that's simply, what's the best way, if somebody's interested, Barry, that they can get in contact with you?
Well, for I don't know how many years since the internet started, but my email is blepatner, B-L-E-P-A-T-N-E-R, at lepatner.com. I get inquiries or people just wanting to say hello or sometimes saying, I finally read your book and it saved my life all the time. And I'm so happy to reach out to everybody in our world of wanting to understand this wonderful world of construction that has made our world so great. I mean, I've had the good fortune. I worked on rebuilding the Statue of Liberty back in the 1980s. I worked on Ellis Island. I've built headquarters facilities for people. I've built schools for governments. I've worked on just wonderful, wonderful projects. And all of it has allowed me to meet fabulous people, people who are well-traveled, articulate, who became great friends. It's a fabulous industry. And I would tell anyone who wants to go into it, find your niche.
It's a big industry.
Don't be a generalist. Find a niche. And with technology, which is hugely needed, the future is all about finding a better way to build a construction mousetrap.
Barry, thank you so very much for hopping on the podcast, and we have to have you on in the future.
Glad to have been here with you, Gordon, and thanks for asking me to come on.
Thanks again to Barry. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star review. Any interactions and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanford, The Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.